that I've asked Dixon to give a talk. And if you look at all our old videotapes, you'll see Dixon's name there. Every few lines, you'll see Dixon's name there. Because he's a great speaker and a great guy. That too. And also that too. And without going into too much detail, Dixon is in his golden years. So I'm thrilled that, you know, as one of the last talks he's giving here, that it is for the summer research program. And thank you for doing it again.
Jay, it's my extreme pleasure, believe me. So what Jay was alluding to was this is my retirement year. So I've only been here since 1970, so still a youngster at heart. And I must say that I've enjoyed all of those years. I can't tell you how much of a reward personally it's been for me. So I'm not giving you my farewell speech. What I'm asking you to do is think about me in my retirement years as a potential speaker for your classes. Because I do a lot of that. I love outreach. So I go to classes. And right, how many classes have I gone to, Jay, from this course?
I'm not even told what you go to.
No, that's right. That's right, that's right.
Okay, you came to my high school.
I came to his high school. I've been to about, I don't know, 10 or 12. If you ask, I will go. So the last one I went to was Horace Mann, which was a wonderful experience because I'd never been there before. So that's my joy out of that, is to see eyes light up. I enjoy watching light bulbs go on. And I haven't been able to do that much here because the light bulbs are already on by the time they get here. And that's your fault. Because for 11 years I've said that if I hadn't gone into what I'm in now, I would have become a science teacher in high school. That was my ambition. Because I was motivated to go on from there by my own high school biology teacher, Mr. Dominic Kasuli, who was a guy. He was a great guy, a terrific man. He shared his personal and professional life with all of his students and made us feel like we were part of his family. And I think that's part of the secret to good teaching, is that you're not really teaching, you're sort of being a friend to somebody, but you're allowing them to know something that you do and you know, whereas they get to tell you things that you're not aware of also. Sometimes you like those things, other times, you know, kids are really doing that? No, I didn't know that. So what, right, but you try not to react. You know, like a doctor just hearing about that from his patient first time. So, okay, so what am I going to talk about? Because for 11 times I've tried to talk about different things, okay? But I haven't managed in the last two times to actually change the subject, although each year of this subject, it's gotten better and better. So what I bring to the table today is an advanced discussion on urban agriculture. Okay, that's the topic, urban agriculture. To show you who's interested in this, I had the extreme pleasure and privilege last week of sitting on the science barge. Does anybody know where the science barge is? Do you know of the science barge? Okay, so guess, well, I won't even ask you to guess, but I will just tell you that on my right was Jan Nelken, on my left was Benjamin Lindsay. These were two professional urban agronomists running separate companies, putting rooftop gardens on apartment houses and schools. By the way, schools. Schools. And interviewing us was none other than Dan Rather. Yeah. So Dan Rather was kind of interested in the topic and kind of asked us to reveal to him our take on urban agriculture. And, of course, I was the professor, so he said, and, professor, what do you, you know. So as soon as I got to the topic of schools, he dropped his notepad. He said, schools, of course. This is the answer. How else can we get people to become aware of the environment, to do something positive, and to feed their families at the same time? If you had built into your schools a vertical farm, and it doesn't have to be a big vertical farm. It could be two stories worth on the top of the roofs or on next to it as built alongside. Anybody here from Bronx High School of Science? No. Why not? Isn't that part of New York City?
It's tough to help their students.
Really? This would be a big help to them, actually. We have on the boards, at least on the architectural and engineering boards, a plan to completely convert the Bronx High School of Science into a zero carbon footprint building with an enormous solar panel for a roof. But why stop there? Why not build a vertical farm adjacent to the school, in fact, add it onto the school and make it part of the science department, that you can look through these solid glass windows from your classrooms to the people working in a three-story agricultural setting, all self-contained. It's snowing like crazy out, and they're raising bananas and getting good crops. What would be wrong with that? Or you go to the commissary or the cafeteria, as it were, and you eat food that was just grown over there. Your class went in and helped pick their lunch. Not bad. Not bad. That's the future of what I want to talk about. But first, I want to get your attention. That's always the case, right? So you have to get their attention first. So here's the way I hope to get your attention. I think I've already got that, but where could you go, right? Besides, you're stuck. You're stuck. So if we hit this little film, just press it. No, not that one. That one. Click twice. Boink. Okay. And we turn up the sound. And then we sit quietly and watch. You have to probably hit something. I think play would be good.
Are you going to talk during the film?
No.
Can I just take a microphone? Is it?
Right. Okay. We actually made that movie here. All right. So I stole from 2001 A Space Odyssey because I thought of an analogy between the HAL 2000 computer and the way the Earth behaves and is integrated. I know you're not going to believe this, but I'm going to tell you anyway. I'm just going to ask you to believe this. 15,000 years ago, which is a long time in human history, not really. 3 million years is a long time. We've been a human species for about the estimate is 400,000 years. So 15,000 years of that 400,000 years. For 15,000 years to the present, the Earth has known how we make our food. Before 15,000 years ago, that is, all the way back to 400,000 years ago, there wasn't a single farm on this planet. None. So the moment we learned how to farm, you think that was a great thing, right? Because we could get enough food and we could have more people. Wait a minute. Then we could get more food and we could have more people. We get another food, we have more people. I'm not against more people, don't get me wrong. That's not my argument. My argument is that once we learned how to grow plants, the plants had us where they wanted us. We were their caretakers. We became the caretakers for plants. You have plants at home? How many people have plants at home? Yep. How many people have plants in your classroom that you teach, here's how plants grow, because you've got them right inside, right? What do plants really need? TLC. We know this, right? You can sing to them, they do better. If you water them to a point, they do better. If you feed them, they do even better. If you overfeed, of course, or if you overwater, or if you overcoddle a child, they will grow up differently than they should have. So the point is that our plants are the same. So here we are from 15,000 years ago. Yep. You can open it. 15,000 years ago to the present, we went from a population of, the estimate is approximately 1 million to 7 billion. 7 billion. Whoa. And just hit slideshow. Great. See, I even have this right. That's called pandering, by the way. You've all learned this, I know, but so just so you know that I know it too. So what I'm going to describe to you is a way that we can throw off the shackles of farming. Oh, I also forgot. Well, I'll get to that as we start to go through this. So we are prisoners of our own device. Does that sound like a line from a song that you might be familiar with? Huh? About the Hotel California by the Eagles. That's where that's from, by the way. So that's, again, pandering to the Ute. So let's see what the first slide says. Here we came 15,000 years ago from the biosphere. Let's see what that's like. Oh, I see. Circles. No beginnings, no ends. You teach this, right? You teach ecology to your students, right? You teach biogeochemical cycles, right? You teach how the carbon cycle works. You teach how the oxygen cycle works. You teach how it's a cycle. Come on, it's a cycle. Things go around. All right. So then we did this. We created, 15,000 years ago to the present, a world which appears, but isn't, devoid of natural selective pressures, for want of a better word. What we have tried to do, systematically, is to move ourselves from Darwin's principles of natural selection to Darwin's other principles of artificial selection. And that's how Darwin can compare and contrast the natural world with the pigeon fanciers, or with the dog and cat raisers, or with racehorses, or with any other form of life that we've had control over. We selectively breed. We artificially select. we have over 15,000 years selected crops, which if you were to turn them loose in the places where they were from originally, they would die just like we would die if they took us back to the old Ivy Gorge and said, go for it. I mean, I can't run that fast. I could never run that fast anyway, but the worst thing you could try to do is outrun a leopard. You know, because they love chasing. And you'll be the first one, right? So the best thing to do is to stay still and pretend you're dead. And then the hyenas will get you. So, you know, it's, you don't win no matter what happens in that situation. So knowing that, we constructed a life for ourselves. Look at us now. We're sitting in an air-conditioned conference room in comfortable chairs. Hopefully you're comfortable. You've had lunch. You're about to fall asleep. And, hey, there's no worries for today. At least we've beat off the wolf from the door, so to speak, because we created this world. This is our world. But, don't forget about this. I didn't say change it. That's okay. Because what I want to do is I want to take the best of the technosphere, and there are some great things about this, and the best of the biosphere. Because if we disappeared tomorrow, the biosphere would be very happy. You've been watching that series, I presume, on television. On the History Channel. It's on the National Geographic Channel. There's a book called The World Without Us. Let me tell you, I will tell you what I'll be doing next year. I will be celebrating the publication of my book. Serious. From the same press that produced The World Without Us, they're producing my book, and I hope it will be called something like The World With Us. The World Without Us is pretty depressing. In fact, it's so depressing that he sold over 300,000 copies. That's how many people wanted to be thoroughly depressed by this topic of what happens if tomorrow we disappeared. The world would be a much happier place if you can measure happiness in terms of how loud a hyena laughs or how loud a baboon laughs, but not how loud, of course, a human laughs, because then we would be gone. So if we could combine the two together, we could get this, which I think everybody would agree, at least in this room, that this is a great combination of two things that, apart from each other, were still good. By the way, that's salmonella-free peanut butter. By the way, I want you to know that last year's recall of peanut products was the largest in U.S. history of any food item. But it ain't over. It ain't over. So what does that mean, too? It means that this topic of raising food inside tall buildings inside the urban landscape, which is the topic, has real currency in terms of food safety, food security, fresh food, teenage obesity, type 2 diabetes, asthma, air pollution, etc., etc., etc. So you have to keep rubbing it, otherwise it won't stay there. Okay, next. So everybody lives with this as their, I hope, biological imperative. That says that everybody who's born deserves this. They don't have to earn it. They deserve it, right? I learned something yesterday from a statistic that somebody sent me. That's, I mean, I almost hesitate to share it with you. Every 5 seconds, a child dies from starvation. From starvation. That's not malaria or tuberculosis or HIV/AIDS. That's starvation. That doesn't mean that there isn't enough food out there to feed that kid either. It just means they didn't get it. You're going ahead of me here. What do you do, put her on automatic? It's okay. Next. Just trying to keep you on your toes here. See, that way you can't fall asleep, right? Isn't that the trick that you use in class also? Okay, class, let's go. You know. Right. So food security and safety, abundant food and safe water, engaging society in sustainable efforts, and reducing our dependence on fossil fuels. We can do all of that in an hour. Next. Here's the way the world looks now. Looks pretty good, actually, and this is the way the world looks now. We're at the height of the growing season. We've got wonderful crops growing this year. The temperatures have been cool. We've had a lot of rain. We're going to get bumper crops in this country. Bumper. Like bumper. You tell a farmer that there's a bumper corn crop coming in, you know what he does? He sits down and cries. Not for joy, because he will get nothing for his corn this year. You know what he hopes for? She/he. They hope that Jones's crop fails, and Smith's crop fails, but not Schwartz's crop. And if Schwartz's crop succeeds and the other two fail, yes, Schwartz has a winner. Isn't that curious? So when Schwartz and Jones and Smith's crops fail, well then, Monsanto steps in and says, you know, I can help you out here. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'll buy your farms. I'll pay you a fair wage every year. You just farm. Who cares if Schwartz's farm fails, if Jones's farm succeeds? Monsanto succeeds. Diversify. You think farmers can afford that in this country? In the year 1932 is what I meant to say, there might have been as many as 6 million farmers in this country. Today, there are 157,000 registered farmers. It's an occupation that doesn't even occur in the census anymore. It's under other. That doesn't mean that there are fewer farms. There's still as many farms, okay? But now they're being managed by large conglomerates. By the way, 80% of what we grow is exported. It's exported under the Farm Aid Bill. Farm Aid last year passed $288 billion, and no one batted an eyelash. In fact, they had to reapportion the bill because they left out an $80 billion package of stuff, and 3 weeks later they trashed the old one and passed the new one by a vote of 85 to 15 for $288 billion. That's incredible. If you want to find out what it said, go to the website verticalfarm.com and you can see it. I got the whole farm bill there. It's 700 and some odd pages. It's an easy read. One night, no problem. Okay, let's see what happened to the world. This is how many acres 7 billion people need to farm and feed themselves. 7 billion people require the entire continent of South America. Yeah, thank you for the wow. You're allowed to say wow, ooh, oh yeah? You can do any of that. If you say oh yeah, you have to step outside. What are you doing? Okay. If we add, no kibitzing here. We're going to work together here. if we add another 3 billion people to the mix, okay, push the button. Just push the space bar. Oh. That didn't show us. Again, please. Then. Push it again. That's it. And push it again. In another 50 years, there'll be 3 billion more people. Oh, well, you didn't know this? Couldn't you hear them screaming and kicking inside all those people? I can. Next. So if 7 billion people need that size, then... Next. 3 billion more people will require the size of Brazil. Let's see how much land's left. Next. Here's how much there is. Next. Here's how much we already use. Gee, if you superimpose Brazil over that, you're going to have a lot of Brazil hanging over the edge. That's not funny, by the way. This is very depressing. 50 years is not that long. If I say 15,000 years, that's a long time. But if I say 50 years, how many here have children? How many have grandchildren? How many have great-grandchildren? I do! They'll all be alive in 50 years. Yeah, that's the deal here. Do you really want them to suffer through this? I don't. Is there anything we can do? Next. So here's what agriculture has done for us. By the way, I had the rare privilege between these two lectures of having given a TED talk. I don't know if you know what TED is, but TED is a... technology, entertainment, and design forum that's held for 3 days, and usually in California, but they have other sites also. So we had some interesting people in my audience, like Quincy Jones and Paul Simon and Meg Ryan And Forrest Whitaker. And we had Al Gore there, he was there. And we had the guy in charge of Tesla Motors, who came up with the $150,000 Roadster that's all electric. So imagine what it's like to go talk in front of these people and try to be casual about it. I was not. I should have been, but I didn't feel very casual when I stood there. So, but these slides were made by the same company that made Al Gore's. Because when they heard about the topic, they saw my PowerPoint presentation. They said, we'll give you Al Gore's slide maker in California. This is Nancy Duart. And she says she's got a book out there also on how to make slides. So I highly recommend it because these are great slides, right? They're wonderful slides. In fact, I had someone come up to me afterwards and said, I didn't actually hear much of what you said because I was concentrating on your slides. Well, that's good because everybody gets a DVD equivalent to this thing, right? So, okay. D-U-A-R-T-E, Duart, Nancy Duart. They're not cheap. But she has a book. The book is cheap. And it has a lot of hints. So if agriculture does this, then let's see what happens next. It requires, oh, I see, all of these things. 20% of the U.S. fossil fuel use is for farming. Can you see okay over there? No. Here. You're welcome. Thank you, thank me, and thank you. It requires herbicides. It requires fertilizers. It requires pesticides. And 70% of the available liquid fresh water. What? Does anybody know, I'm sure you do, where 20% of the liquid fresh water is? It's in one place. Huh? No. That's not in one place. Silly goose. You'll edit this out, of course. No, leave it in. Leave it in. I want the students to see that we can be as stupid as they can be under certain circumstances. No, if you go to a world map and you look to see... I see she has a local reputation. If you go to a world map and point to the map, there is one place on the map that you can say 20% of the liquid fresh water is there.
Oh, the Great
Lake issue. Where?
Green
Lake. No! No, I said liquid fresh water, liquid fresh water. Not even close. Well, I'll give you another guess, though. You're on the right track. Name some other lake.
Lake Victoria?
Baikal.
Bingo. Lake Baikal. Imagine that, 20% of the liquid fresh water is in one place. That means only 80% left, and of that, we use 70% for farming. And we contaminate it with agricultural runoff. Let's see what the next slide says. So we produce food, sure, but we get runoff. Who cares? Oh, I know you care. You do care. I'll show you what happens to runoff. The next one. Look at this. These are the world's estuaries. And this is a conservative estimate as to the damage of the estuary by agricultural runoff from the farmland to the rivers to the oceans. Get it? And you can't use the water again. So I just got back from Jordan. Not Michael, the country. 2, 3, 4. And my son's a stand-up comic, so he's taught me a lot of this stuff, so please bear with me. And if I could borrow that bottle of water, I'll give it back. If this is the amount of water that Jordan has to deal with, the whole enchilada, then 20 years ago, Jordan was a country that only required this much. They only had 2.5 million people. 20 years later, today, they have 5 million people. They now use all of their water. What do you think is going to happen in 20 years? I can guarantee you what's going to happen in 20 years. There'll be 10 million Jordanians. How do I know that? Because they told me. They know this already. They have an 80% literacy rate, 77,000 plus engineers that helped the entire Middle East engineer Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Qatar, all those other places. But they have that much water. That's it. So, yeah, I don't blame you. You're shaking your head. What the hell's going to go on? I mean, how are they going to accomplish anything without water. So what are they doing now to make that formula even practical? They're draining ancient aquifers. Now, the irony of it all was, I'm standing in front of a group of people like this, trying not to pontificate. And this is the Royal Science Society of Jordan. It's only 10 years old, but that's okay, because it was packed, right? And I said to them, I am painfully aware of where I'm standing today, because if I were to travel 200 miles northeast from here, I would encounter the Damascus Oasis, which is the earliest known agricultural site on Earth. It's where farming was discovered, invented. The hair on the back of my neck stood up. They understood what I was saying, because I said to them, if you think you can go on growing crops the way you're doing it now, you are delusional. You know this. They all said yes. I said, your options are few, but they're good. One of them is hydroponics, and the other one is aeroponics, which I'll get to. I'm from New Orleans. How long do I have for this? Oh, I'm going to have to fast forward then. Another slide, please. Next. Yeah, this is where I'm from. So these three floods, Hurricane Katrina, forget about it. Over here someplace. A minor event compared to these three. Really? Yeah, really. It trashed the entire coast from New Orleans all the way to Brownsville, Texas. It killed off all the wildlife because of the nitrogen in the fertilizer, which scavenges oxygen. So as soon as the agricultural runoff hit, it's gone. It's called dead zone now. You look it up on the internet, on Google Images, and ask for dead zone. You get a few weird things, but you'll also get this. You might even see her in high school. And no, that's not true. Next slide. So, within 20 years from now, the entire world will live this way, but we already live this way. We do. And we like it. Because why? Because that's where everybody lives. How would you like to live in the middle of no place? That's why we call it that. The middle of no place. I want to be someplace. Okay, you want to be someplace? You better behave like it's no place. Next slide, please. So, here's my question. Can we provide a sustainable, safe, and abundant food and water supply for 10 billion people? 10 billion people, not 7, 10, because we got another 50 years to think about here. We can already supply enough food for 7. Oh, is that right? You just told me that every 5 minutes, a child dies from starvation. How do you account for that? Sloppy trade agreements, rotten governments. That's how I account for that. Just, it's that simple. And it's not a black or white problem either. It's a poor people problem. That's what it is. So poor is poor. Don't care where you live, right? Doesn't matter. Matters that you're poor. Can we do this? Sure, at the expense of Brazil. That's absurd. Next. But we have to do something else, too. If you don't do this, then you have another 50 years to live. What do you care? I know no one in this room is going to live another 50 years. Maybe. I could say that. You might live to 100 if you're lucky. But in this atmosphere, living to 100 isn't lucky. It's depressing. Every year gets more depressing to realize that you're leaving nothing behind except depression. Next, please. So I think we can do both. That's why I'm here, to tell you how I think we can do both. It's not me talking here, though. What you're listening to are 94 gifted, dedicated, hardworking volunteers. We call them graduate students. But I give this course as an elective. They don't have to take it. It's called medical ecology. So the students in the School of Public Health, in the medical school and the law school and SEPA and CERC and a whole bunch of other places at Columbia have volunteered to take this course because they thought it was interesting. which flatters me because I invented it. It's called medical ecology. And in this course, we tried to think through the biggest problem of how do you think about the next 50 years? And it occurred to them that if you don't involve food into the equation and water, then it doesn't matter what else you talk about, because the rest is kind of window dressing. Okay, so let's see how this could work after 11 years of hard work. Say no more, say no more. This is it. I know that doesn't seem very natural, right? How many people here, when you think about farming and you think about hydroponics, makes that an equivalent activity? Right. How many people think farming, that's natural? You know, it's the earth. It's what you put seeds in. It's what's come up. It's what we've done. And this is factory food. Just factory food. Let's just get rid of it. Just hate it. Tomatoes don't taste right. It's got grow lights, lots of energy, takes some space. Well, just remember to think back 15,000 years ago and how natural a process farming actually is. There isn't a single farm on the planet now that isn't human, except for one, leaf cutter ants. That's a real exception, but, you know, leaf cutter ants haven't really impacted the world like we have. Even E.O. Wilson admits that. And he discovered leaf cutter ants. So leaf cutter ants cut leaves, they grow fungus, they eat the fungus.
Right.
Some questions here. How do the ants keep other fungi from eating their leaves other than the one they want? And the answer is, oh, you know?
I believe, I saw it on a Discovery Channel. I believe it's something on their...
Yes!
Wow.
An observant, and she listens, and she didn't fall asleep. So the ants contain bacteria in their pores, on their cuticles, which manufactures an antifungal agent which kills every other fungus except that one. So here's the bigger question then. How come the other fungi haven't become resistant over millions and millions of years? And yet every time we try it, the antibiotics don't work after a while. What's going on here? No answer to that yet. We don't know. Anyway, this is as unnatural a way of growing food as growing food in soil is an unnatural way of growing food. Growing food is unnatural. Having 7 billion of anything is unnatural. It's just plain ecologically stupid. Unless you're a good observer. Unless you can look at nature and say, how do they do it? How do they do it? What is that called? If we could imitate that, what would that be called? We have a word for this. Biomimicry. Do we do that in anything? Sure. We biomimic all over the place. At this TED lecture that I gave, there was another guy there. He could teach you how to crawl up a wall like a gecko. How do geckos do that? Good question. So to know the answer means you have to investigate. So geckos, first of all, if their hands point in this direction, here's the wall and here's their hands, ours point this way, right? Theirs points this way, so when they let go, they can, like Velcro, rip the soles of their hands off of the glass that they're on so they can put it up to walk, all right? So that's one thing. Their feet recoil in exactly the opposite direction as our fingers go because they need to take it off the surface. And the reason why they can stay there is because of nanotubes. If you get down to the nanotube level, the surface charge between the nanotubes and the surface of the glass is so intense that they can just stick to it like Velcro. It's electrostatic forces. So he made a pair of gloves like that. This guy was crazy. And he went up to a blank wall of glass and he went, you know, like, and he pulled himself up and actually suspended himself on the glass. And then to get off, he would just fell down. That was cool. But that's trivial. You know, it's for Spider-Man. It's not for us. So what can we do at a societal level which mimics the natural world. I know. After 11 years, I finally know. We can imitate an ecosystem. We can observe an ecosystem, and then we can behave like it. Good idea. Why is that a good idea? Because ecosystems are balanced, the ones we haven't disturbed much. We've disturbed them all, but the ones we haven't disturbed much still function quite well. And so let's see what they look like. So here's how to do it. Next. And we get this. Okay. Let's just go out and do this. Next. Here are some advantages. We can go through these very fast. No runoff. Year-round crop production. No crops lost due to severe weather events. Uses 70% less water than ordinary agriculture. Restoration of damaged ecosystems. Now, if Billy May hadn't died, I would have done a great Billy May just then. But I feel sorry for that guy because he bumped his head on an airplane, getting out of the airplane, and he died. And you know this guy, right, because he's on television all over the place. But I once did a takeoff on Billy May for the vertical farm. And if you order today, you got two of them, but we can't give this offer forever. Maybe I'll do it like ShamWow. Okay, so next. So here's how to slow down rapid climate change. If we could grow our food indoors, we don't need the outdoors anymore. What would we do with the outdoors? Let it grow back. If it grows back, trees suck up carbon. Carbon is what's the problem. We put it there. So we have a way to do this now. FAO all the time says, it's too bad we can't replant the trees, because if we could, we could suck up most of the carbon in the atmosphere that we put there, because we have to farm on the forests that we just cut down. So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. If 3 billion more people need the size of Brazil in terms of traditional farming, go back and read the article in Science 2001. It's called Forecasting Agriculture for the Next 50 Years. Actually, don't go back and read the article. It will depress you beyond belief. I think about that article every day. And these were serious conservative agronomists. So we can grow our food in buildings inside the urban landscape, and we can let the rural areas repair themselves, and we can pay the farmers an equitable price for trees rather than corn and let them have a living that's better than the one they have now, because they don't have to worry about crop failures. And when they die, nobody owns those forests anymore. Sorry. That's where the legacy ends. This becomes public domain at the end of your term. Next. So here's what we want to do. What's the basis for an ecosystem? Well, I'll be very rapid with this one. Sunlight, plants, animals, animals that eat animals, they all die, the microbes eat everything, recycles. Okay, that's 15 seconds worth of ecosystem. But you don't have to know more than that, because sunlight, plants, is the secret. That's called primary. What are you doing to me? Please, please, please. Please. Por favor. We need to behave like an ecosystem. We can't now because we can't make our own food. Yes, we can. We can do it inside the city. If we can do that, and we have all the tools, then the city looks like this. That's cool. Okay. All of the drinking water turns into urine. All of the food turns into feces. Those are valuable resources, children. Valuable resources. Do you know how much... No, I'll phrase that another way. But you knew where I was going. How many kilowatt hours of electricity would we generate if we could take all of the human feces from New York's production for a year and incinerate it in a high-tech incinerator? And the answer is 1 billion kilowatt hours of electricity. 1 billion kilowatt hours of electricity per 8 million people. Do you know how much water New York City throws away every day in terms of gray water? You're afraid to ask me now, I bet. Yeah, it's the same figure. It's 1 billion gallons of water every day from 14 treatment plants. Now, I said that to an audience in Jordan. How many people here, raise your hands, could use 1 billion gallons of fresh drinking water every day? They thought I was stupid, but they raised their hand anyway. I said, the reason why I asked you this is because New York City throws that much away every day. Why are they throwing it away when you guys need it? Why is Chicago doing that? Why is Washington, D.C. doing that? Why is Atlanta doing that? Why is San Francisco doing that? Why is Seattle doing that? Why is Orange County... Oh, wait. Orange County isn't doing it anymore. Orange County is the exception to the rule. Orange County was doing it. They went to Arnold in California, to the Gov, and said, we need more water because we're rich and we want to grow. We'll work together on this. We'll work. We're going to work it out. We're going to take it on the road. We're going to work it out. It's okay. So Arnold said to this, I think he said it to the county agent. He said, I won't do Arnold, but my son can do Arnold. We can't, are you kidding me? You're asking me to take water away from somebody who can't afford it because you can't afford it? Find water somewhere else. If you can't, you can't grow. Too bad. So they went back and they thought about this. They hired some experts and they said, you know, you actually do produce water, but it's urine. I know it's mine. No, it's urine. Oh, it's urine. we can't do that. Can we? Let's see. Next. Just hit the space bar. Yeah, okay, here. Just stay there. Can we do this? You're darn right we can. What do you mean we can do it? We do it! It's not a can. We do it. This is done already. This is a done deal. Orange County gets its drinking water from the ground. Of course, it puts the water into the ground to begin with, because people wouldn't dare drink this stuff coming out of the factory. They spent $500 million on this plant to take urine and change it into drinking water. It's called From Toilet to Tap. If you doubt it, go back to the New York Times Magazine section about 6 months ago, and that was the article. Now they can grow. In fact, they can grow as big as they want because they can get all the water back. That's not a miracle, by the way. That's just valuing your resources. It's not stupid. It's very smart. But they were forced up against a wall in order to do it. That's not a good way to be forced into anything. No one likes to be forced to do anything. So that's why we haven't done it yet, because no one's there to force us. 50 years from now, we'll all be doing it, I guarantee you. Mark my words, I'll be recycling. But you will still be here. And you'll think about this and say, you know, that guy said this, and he was right. And then you'll be having the following conversation. You know, we used to burn oil? No. What? They burned it? Oh, my God, look what we can do with it. Yeah, that's true, by the way. So, okay, and then the other part of the equation is you take the solid waste, New York City's sludge, and pass it through a device called the plasma gasification device. It's not a miracle device. It works. It's now on the campus of MIT as their primary way of recovering energy from solid waste. Port St. Lucie, that's where the Mets work out. They should use a little more work. I know that. That's okay. LUCIE, that's right. It's probably correct on this map. That's my spelling. That's authorial of spelling. They process 1,500 tons of garbage every day through the plasma arc gasification device, and they recover the heavy metals. And they get syngas, that's synthetic gas, which they then burn and get energy from. The heat that this thing generates makes the energy to run itself. So let's say that you got no energy back, but you still got rid of all your waste. That's still a good deal, because you now have fresh kills to deal with. And we have half a mountain in New Jersey. That's... Jay, I'm getting too old here. Jimmy Hoffa, come on. Jimmy Hoffa, the teamster that got killed. No, we don't know about this. They call him Touchdown Jimmy because he's in Giants. Oh, okay. The point is that we know how to do all of this. So if New York City throws away a billion gallons of water from a reservoir system that only holds 520 billion gallons to begin with, if we had a two-year drought, it's all gone. A two-year drought, that's nothing. In terms of the geologic record, there have been 20 and 40 and 70-year droughts. No water, zero. How would you like that? Nobody would like that. You'd lose the reservoir systems. You'd have to drink bottled water from some other place. It would be incredibly expensive. Now you know what it's like to be in Jordan. That's what it's like to be in Jordan. And it's going to get worse. It isn't going to get better. So the next war in the Middle East will not be over oil or religion. It's going to be over water. Even they admit that now. So here are some designs. Just, you can go through these. Just go through them. No explanation necessary. Just pretty pictures of imaginary vertical farms. That's a real one, by the way. These are real. Here's one we took to Dubai. You know, figured maybe they'll pay for it. Maybe they won't. It doesn't really matter, though, because a lot of these designs are fanciful, that they won't work. But you know what they did? They captured the imagination of the public, and they grew this idea to national prominence. So now, we'll give you the height of vanity. As far as I'm concerned, I'll tell you the story when we finish looking through these slides. So we're being featured at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, and here you might recognize this face, but here's a scale model of what a vertical farm might look like, but it's still highly imaginary and highly fanciful. That's the best one. Okay, go back to your schools and do this. I'm serious. Do it. Do it like a Lego project. You know, tell the kids to go back to their homes and think about how would you grow food in a multiple-story building. Jay's daughter's class did that, and they're now listed on the website. Every one of them wrote a beautiful letter with a little house on it or signed your best friend, Al. I love it when they do that because I would like to be your best friend. So I'm going to thank all these. These are my best friends now. So what you're looking at here are 94 gifted, highly selected, bright people, and one instructor. These all graduated, every one of them. They have jobs. That's another miracle. And now, there's one student and 94 instructors, because they're going to tell me how to do this. There isn't one of them that wouldn't work on this project for money if they could be offered a job at it, right? So as far as I'm concerned, it's definitely time for me to stop talking. It's also time for us to start doing, okay? So, that's it. Thank you. So, I must tell you this vanity story then, because this is my last lecture, what the hell, who cares? you know, a lot of this has a potential for going to your head if you take yourself too serious, so you shouldn't do that. I was told early on in my career here that if you don't take yourself serious, but some other person does, then it's to your advantage. You know, you can go home and sort of smile about it, right? So my wife and I are riding down the subway to go to this year's opening for the